So once again, I'm glad to be here and to share with you events from the Middle East that I think that we understand that all of us are part of what is going on. I've been doing this for many years, and when I started coming to the U.S. about 20-something years ago and tried to tell American friends of Israel that what happens in the Middle East doesn't happen in an area which you're watching with concern, but from a distance, it's going to be our problem. And unfortunately, I think that we all understand we're in it together because it's not a limited problem that happens behind the ocean. It happens every place on the planet. And therefore, the better we understand the mindset over there, the better we understand how people think in this part of the world, it will give us some keys, right, to understand what to expect and what is going on. Let me submit to you that if your knowledge of the Middle East is coming from academic studies in Yale or Harvard or Princeton, you don't know the Middle East. And unfortunately, the advisors of presidents and leaders know the Middle East on an academic level, and that's not enough. Unless you understand the mindset, unless you understand the mentality, and how can you get that when you go 3 years to university, when you live in a country that everything here is based on common sense, on a handshake, we may have debates and problems, but we'll find a solution. That kind of logic doesn't work in the Middle East. And sometimes you watch in awe and you don't get it. What's your problem? Yes, you do have some issues over there, but can't you find a solution? Well, the very question explains that people do not understand the nature of the problem. And therefore this evening, as challenging as that may be, I would like in about short 45 to 50 minutes give you some keys to understand by using some examples. And maybe you will, maybe you won't, but it's not an easy mindset to try to accept. And let me also guarantee to you that with all the pressure in the region, Israel is strong, Israel is prosperous, we don't put our helmets on every day to take fire, we know how to protect ourselves, because sometimes you hear the message, people think to themselves, poor people, how can they even survive over there? Well, if God is with you, who can be against you? So we do know that, and we do know how the book ends, we don't know the timing, and therefore we are prepared, we know how to protect ourselves, and that pressure that we are taking every now and then is just to explain what may happen to other, let's call it Western democracies, unless we open our eyes and we understand what is it that we are facing. It's over there. I'm going to use the screen, all right? The Galilee Academy is kind of an adventure that I started with a friend of mine, and we were hoping to bring people over to teach about Israel. Well, since nobody's coming over, thanks to COVID, we come over here, and we'll try to share some of these things with you. And again, today it's easy for me to get Americans' attention. But about 20 years ago, everybody was looking at me and said, okay, you know, we are concerned, it's Israel. The Bible basically teaches us about the country. We are praying for Israel, friends of Israel. But it happens so far away. I think that all of us can agree today, we are all in it together. And geography and oceans are not big enough today to protect anybody. So at least we understand what is it that we're talking about. I do want to be more zoomed in, if I may, and to start with an overview to explain the big problem in the region, and then to zoom in and say a few words about Israel versus Hamas in Gaza, because through the story of one group of Palestinian, I will call them terrorists, I will call them freedom fighters, you can basically double that, you can triple that. You need to understand that mindset, and Hamas will be an example, because once you understand the way they think, you understand Muslim Brotherhood, you understand ISIS, and ISIS is still around. Don't make any mistakes. ISIS is not going anywhere. And you do understand the core issue over there. So I just chose Hamas because they are right our neighbor, and that's what makes the news every now and then, Israel vis-a-vis Hamas. So that would be maybe one of the titles, but not the only one. That's what comes up? Yeah. So let's go straight to the other one. Let me start with a quote. Some of you read the book, I'm sure. It's confusing. Because when you look around the Middle East today, you can be an optimist. Because suddenly Israel has friends in the region. The Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia maybe. If I had asked you 10 years ago, Middle East enemies, how do you arrange them? You will tell me, you're right, Israel is on one side, and all the Arab countries is a monolith on the other side. Israel is the only country, and the whole Middle East is against Israel. Well, that's no longer the case. It's no longer the case because things happen in the region, and many of the Arab neighbors that thought that Israel should be wiped out from the surface of the planet begin to understand that they need Israel more than they're willing to admit. And Israel is a solution and not a problem. When I speak about a problem, I speak about the main threat to the stability in the region, the only threat that we have for our survival. We take it very seriously, and that will be Iran. And therefore, we have to view everything through one scope. The scope will be the growing power of Iran, how it affects Muslim Sunni countries. I'm not going to this distinction of Sunnis and Shiites. That's not the main point for tonight. But people in the Middle East begin to understand that if Iran is getting even stronger, they will be the first target, not Israel, and they have somebody to protect them. Israel is strong enough to be a shelter, if you wish, to these countries as well. Because the first target of Iran will be Saudi Arabia, and then Egypt, and then Jordan, because Iran says loud and clear, number one, we aspire to consolidate all the Muslim world. Number two, we'll go to take out Israel. And therefore, we will be the little Satan. You're the big Satan, make no mistake. That's the kind of language you're using over there. And everything that happens in the region, one eye is always looking at what happens in Tehran. And you know what? I'm disappointed to tell you that so far, they're winning. So far, the Iranians have every reason to be encouraged by what they see around them. And pulling out from Afghanistan is just one example, not the only one. Because the USFA is out of Iraq officially and out of Syria as well. I'm not criticizing American policy. It's not my position. It's not my right. I can try to tell you how we see that in Israel and what are our main concerns. Right? And therefore, it's not even what happens on the ground. It's what is the message that the other party gets. Because they don't see that as clever politics. They don't see that as the U.S. made the decision. They don't want boots on the ground in Afghanistan anymore because of different reasons. For them, it's a great victory. We defeated the superpower of the world. And that's a booster. That can encourage so many groups in the region. And the first people there to take the heat of that booster is Israel. And therefore, we are dealing with something which is not directly concerning us. But we are going to take the heat because of those decisions. And once again, it's not criticizing America's policy, because today you can accomplish almost everything without having boots on the ground, almost everything. And therefore, the fact that you're not there doesn't mean that the American Air Force cannot go and wipe out half of Afghanistan. That's not the point. The point is, what is the message and how the local radical Muslim groups in the region understand? Well, they see that the U.S. is out, Russia is kind of in, Turkey is involved. This whole dynamic is changing, and that affects everybody in the region, and of course the state of Israel as well. And therefore, I'm going to use Gaza, but just as an example, to understand the bigger story. Well, here is what I would like to share with you now. Is it working? It's working. Number one, that you absolutely need to know, and that's not going to change. The Muslim mindset. I'm not speaking about Arabs. Please make the distinction. Islam is a religion. If you believe in the Muslim faith, you're a Muslim, not an Arab necessarily. All right? Most of the Muslims in the world are not Arabs. Indonesia, Malaysia, Iran, Turkey, all of them practice the Muslim faith. They are not Arabs. Arab is not a race. Arab is not a nationality. Arab is not a religion. It's a civilization, a culture, a language, a mindset. You can be an American Arab as well. That's how they will call themselves if you came from an Arab country. You're a citizen of America. It may be a nationality, but your culture is still Arab. So you can be an Israeli Arab. You can be Muslim, you can be Christian. Confused? Of course you are, everybody is. But this is important to know. And therefore the issue is not that much Israeli Arab, but more Israeli Muslim. Let me ask you this. What is the problem of Iran with the state of Israel? And it was a major problem. We are not neighbors. We never went to any war against one another. The last time we had a problem was in the days of Mordecai and Esther and Haman. That's a long time ago. What is the problem of Iran with Israel? Nobody asked the question, huh? They cannot even say that we occupied their territory, they want it back. They cannot even say we want to show solidarity to our Arab brothers. In one word, Islam. And for that reason, if you're viewing the area from a religious point of view, you do understand this is a dead end, because religions don't negotiate. Because your God did not authorize you to make concessions in his behalf. If you follow the Quran, as many Muslims do, there's no room for negotiations. And therefore, once the agenda is Muslim, religious, in a way, the path to conflict is paved. Because if you will speak in behalf of a national sentiment, we can negotiate. Nations know how to come to some conclusions and how to give up and how to... There is a way to do that. But once you bring that to the religious level, this is it. End of story. It's not going anywhere peacefully. And for years and years and years, the Israeli mindset was, we're going to speak to Arab nations. We're going to make peace with Egypt, and we did. With Jordan, and we did. What about the Palestinians? It looked like it's going to work, because the Palestinians used to speak in a language that focused on the national agenda. Not anymore today. Today, the Palestinians are Hamas, basically, and Hamas is a Muslim group, and they don't care about national Palestinians. They speak about the dominion of Hamas, the victory of Islam, and that changes everything. And Israel is also a little confused, what is it that we need to do now, and who will be a potential partner in the future. But the U.S. has the same problems. Who is reliable? Who can you talk to? Who can deliver? What is the mindset of the Iranians coming to the negotiation table? You don't have a clue. Because who offered negotiations? The West. Who offers negotiations in the Muslim mindset? The weak party. If you're strong, you go and get it. You don't offer negotiations. Which means once you want to negotiate, you give the other party an encouragement. They are winning. Why give up now? Amazing. Today, as we speak, the Western world is begging Iran to come back to the negotiation table, I kid you not, and they say, no, why would we? We know weakness, we'll take the time, we'll get more from you. So unless you understand the kind of mindset, it's hard to make decisions to which direction you want to go and how this may end. So one thing is beyond any controversy, the Muslim mindset will never, ever accept the existence of a Jewish state in the very midst of what they believe is Muslim sacred land. That's a given, not going to happen. And when you listen to the messages delivered by Muslim clergy or by Palestinian leaders, this will be it. No Muslim leader in the world ever made the following statement. I believe that the Jews have rights. Don't tell us how much the land. The Jews have rights for a national home in Israel. Once one leader will be courageous enough to say that, problem is over. Let's now negotiate. But first, recognize our right. They cannot say that and live. One did, Sadat from Egypt, he was murdered. And therefore, to speak about what is the motivation, we have to be honest enough to say the motivation is religious. And the problem is, it's not good news. Because there was no way to make any progress when this is what we have on the table. Now, since the Middle East is made of countries which are not really democracies, you may tell me, listen, you're talking to the regimes, and the regimes are not representing the people. So maybe if you get rid of the regime, you get to the people, you'll find a different mindset. They love the Jews. They like Israel. Why not? Well, that'll be a challenge. Twice, only twice in the region, the Muslim people in countries went to free elections. It happened in Egypt in 2012. It happened among the Palestinians in 1907, free elections. The Western world was sending monitors. They approved that everything was done by democratic principles. It was as close as we can come to understand what is the will of the people. Who won the elections in both cases, by the way, with a huge majority. 75% of the vote in Egypt went to the Muslim Brotherhood. Among the Palestinians, 65% to the Muslim Brotherhood and 15% to the Salafists, all right, all the other. In other words, when you have the chance to talk to the common people and try to look at their sentiment, it's very, very, very pro-Muslim agenda and not a national one, basically. So it's not that the regimes are more brutal. It's not that the regimes are anti-Israeli. They do reflect the sentiment of most people. Now let me ask you this, because our mindset is so different. When you say that you are voting for Sharia law, the way we see it, our principles, you are voting basically for poverty, you are voting for radicalism, you are voting for no rights for women, no rights for children, you are voting for child abuse, you are voting for all kinds of things that we do not believe in. And you tell me, who in his right mind is going to vote for such a party? Would you do that? And therefore, what we call freedom, what we call happiness, what we call human rights, these are principles that the Muslim world is not sharing. And I cannot say that they are right or wrong. I'm just bringing in the idea that we do not understand how other people think, because we know so better. We are offering human rights. What can be wrong with human rights? Human rights are human rights, right? Well, just a minute now. What are the rights that some people fight for? If you fight for the right to take me out, I don't want you to have such rights. Is my point clear? And therefore, before we start to making big steps and negotiate to bring peace to the region, we need to understand the mindset. And the mindset in the Middle East, from Afghanistan all the way to Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, many of these countries no longer exist, by the way, thanks to the Arab Spring. What a stupid term is that, the Arab Spring. It's a freezing Muslim winter, not the Arab Spring. So these countries no longer exist. So once you understand the motivation, you have to do some rethinking. I'm going to make an agreement with the regime that doesn't represent the people, not very stable. Can they deliver? Can we trust them? You do understand that trying to navigate your way politically in such an ocean is not easy. And we make mistakes all the time. At least we know today what path not to take, because we understand the mindset of the other side. The Western world doesn't understand it so far. But you will. And unfortunately, the hard way. Just like we did. Let me give you some examples about speeches and about statements that were made by very prominent Arab and Muslim leaders in the area. And once you understand the mindset, these are from about 10 years ago, it leaves a little hope that we can really negotiate any kind of peace settlement. They tell you loud and clear, we'll never accept the existence of the Jewish state in what we call Muslim sacred area. And it's not just propaganda, that's what they believe in. I need to ask you, again, I'm not very disciplined with as a speaker, so a few things will come up over there which have nothing to do with what I'm sharing with you, although I can see the presentation right in front of me, so please bear with me, and I hope that you are used to my funny accent by now, so that will make things a little easier. But you're still with me, right, I'm sure, so let's just carry on. As I said, due to some of the issues in the region, you see a new fault line in the Middle East now, and Israel is very comfortable to find ourselves siding with other countries, other nations, not because they like us all of a sudden, because they need us. By the way, you can make peace with a neighbor like Egypt. It doesn't mean much. It only means that there's no war between the two. The borders are not open. Israelis don't go to Egypt. Egyptians don't come to Israel. Yes, we have embassies, but the Israeli ambassador in Egypt met with a parliament member. Just a friendly talk, right? He's the ambassador, and that member under pressure had to abdicate because we don't talk to the enemy. And we are at peace, to remind you. So there's no normalization. So be it. They don't like us, we don't like them, it's fine. At least we don't kill one another. So speaking about peace, it's not the US and Canada. We speak about a different kind of peace. But again, that's the Middle East. We are content. As long as people are not getting killed along the borders, that's fine enough. But you do see the new fault line. And you do see that Israel is not all by itself. And even in the other group of Iran and Turkey, they're not good friends either. All right, so the other side, or the side, the Israeli side, is a little more organized, so to speak, a little more connected on the other side, which is a side. There's a lot of struggle between Turkey and Iran. Listen to that for just a minute, all right? The two strongest powers in the Muslim world today are non-Arabs. One is Turkey, Turks, all right, which is a Sunni power. The other one, Iran, who are Farsis, is the Shiite power. So the two mighty armies, the two mighty Muslim nations in the region, are fighting over dominating Islam, and they are not Arab. We speak about others. That's a humiliation to the Arabs to begin with. And by the way, the Shiite power, and they only make about 15% of Islam are the Shiites, will have the nuclear weapon. Let me surprise you, I'm sorry to bring you bad news, Iran will have nuclear weapons. Too late to stop them. Regardless of what President Biden says, regardless of what my Prime Minister says, Bennett, Iran will have nuclear weapons. But you know what, let me be a little more specific. Well, what's a weapon? Let me try to explain, okay? Just to show you how you can manipulate easily every kind of term. In the case of Iran, the way they see that, you have to have a ballistic missile and you have to have a nuclear warhead on the ballistic missile. Now, these are not manufactured in the same place. Iran is enriching uranium. They can make the nuclear warhead within months. But it's not on the ballistic missile. So when it is becoming to be a weapon? Only when the warhead is on the missile? Or maybe when you have everything ready and it's only a matter of weeks to put them together to have nuclear weapons? Well, they will have the warheads. They have the missiles, but it's not a weapon. So President Biden can say, am I prime minister? We will never allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. Politics? Politics. Okay, so this is just one of these new answers. And hey, don't trust me. I don't have any inside information. My prime minister is not calling me to ask for my advice. He never did, by the way. Do some reading. I think that it's very clearly stated by the Iranians today. They don't hide their intentions. We need to give them that credit. They do not hide their intentions anymore. Because for years, it was for peaceful purposes. Yeah, sure. You need a ballistic rocket for peaceful purposes, okay? Being a little sarcastic here, as you understand. Well, let's speak about the main changes in the region. And of course, the Arab Spring was the one that led to most of these changes. And there was one big winner. And the big winner will be indeed Iran. Iran did not initiate all these unrests in the region. But once they started, and the local governments were losing power, Iran was the first country in to support the local opposition, in most cases the Shiite opposition, to control those nations. Many countries in the Middle East no longer exist. There is no country called Syria. There is no country called Lebanon. There is no country called Yemen, no country called Iraq. If one way to define a country is an entity that has a sovereign government protecting its territory, these countries would not qualify. All the decisions happen in Tehran. There are those that will decide what happens in Syria and Lebanon, etc. And you see the map. Iran is quite far away. But you do see those arrows because there's only one target for the Iranians, and they say it loud and clear. They want to supply the proxies to be ready for war against Israel. And therefore, the war goes on a kind of a low-intense conflict, that's how they call it, all right, in low intensity. But things happen all the time. A war doesn't have to be air forces taking off and columns of tanks invading territory. 21st century is learning about a new kind of a war and not a conventional one, and we are in the midst of that. So Iran is working through proxies, exploiting the unrest in the Arab countries. It's their interest to encourage chaos. Chaos and instability are doing Iran a great service. And I'm using them as an example because, not an example, because they are the main issue. And the whole world is occupied with the nuclear deal. The nuclear deal is a problem, but while we are looking at that direction, we simply ignore what happens on the ground every day. New militias, more weapons. All we can do in Israel is to watch what happens, and whenever we have a clear target, we'll take it out. Because they're not playing games. Hezbollah in Lebanon is a proxy of Iran, and they have 200,000 rockets. They're not collecting them. They're going to use them. Now we know that, so what are we waiting for? You can feel some of my frustration. Because nothing happened so far. Maybe they just collect the rockets, and then they're going to throw them into the ocean to see which one floats longer. We understand what happens. But we need to consider the world. And the world will not understand Israel launching an attack without being provoked in a way. Having those weapons is a provocation to begin with. And therefore you hear all kind of something in the news. A caravan of trucks that was going from here to there was attacked by somebody that didn't want these trucks to get to Lebanon. Sometimes Israel says, okay, that was us. In most cases we don't admit that they were, but it's very obvious what is going on. We control the airspace. We control the seas. We do not control the ground routes. And for that reason, Syria, for example, which is over there, is an essential link for Iran to have a land bridge, if you wish, to keep supplying their proxies in Lebanon with weapons. And by the way, the last American troops who are still deploying in the area are deployed there to try to block that corridor. So they're not free to do that. But once the last U.S. soldier will leave the area, nothing will stop them, except our Air Force. And you're limited to what extent you can do that. So we see how the tension is building up on our borders, and all we can do is to be prepared and try to take out very selectively targets that we believe may be game changers. And it happens all the time. And once again, If you've not been to Israel, you may have the impression, oh gosh, you have to live in bomb shelters all day long. No, it doesn't happen like that. Life goes on, and as I said, prosperous country, free, and a beautiful one as well. We just have to be well prepared. And that's what readiness means, to have the awareness that things may happen, to be prepared. In my country, everybody serves in the army. You're 18 years of age, you're called to protect your country. We are proud to do that, and we are prepared. And once again, I believe we are the strongest nation in the region. Whatever happens, we are strong enough, right? Not just to protect ourselves, but to protect potential allies if necessary. Let me zoom in now and say a few words about the Israel and the neighbors, or the Palestinians and the other countries. Each one of the arrows that you see over there is pointing at a place that has Iranian presence. It can be Iranian personnel directly, or maybe advisors who are advising the locals. But then sometimes you hear something interesting and say, no, Israel took something out, and Iran will say, well, that were not our people, just some local advisors, and then there was a big funeral in Tehran. So you don't understand how it works. You cannot hide a funeral, okay? So enough with that. Iranians are wearing Syrian army uniforms, and to fool the world, we know how it works. Nobody's fooled by that anymore, and it happens almost on a daily basis. So Iran has such presence. You see Jordan, the green area over there, which is an ally of the U.S., by the way, and Israel as well. Jordan is kind of a buffer zone, because behind Jordan is Iraq, and Iraq is Iranian territory. So we do see how things are kind of building up on our borders, but since you speak with Syria and Lebanon, things are quite quiet over there. The hotspot will be vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And every now and then, as you well know, rockets are flying from Gaza, we retaliate somehow. Iron Dome, yes, Iron Dome, no. It's like a stupid game that we play for a long time because nobody wants to take it one step further, because the way Israel sees everything, Hamas in Gaza is a small problem. We want to be ready for the big problem, and that will be Iran. And for that reason, to send an army into Gaza in order to destroy Hamas, which is possible, will take too much resources. We want to make sure that we are okay with Hamas in Gaza. We'll get to them in just a minute, because we do want to focus on the northern side, and the northern border is indeed Iran's proxies. By the way, nothing new under the sun. The prophet Jeremiah prophesied many years ago to King Zedekiah, watch out, man, the enemy is coming from north. So the enemy is always, he spoke about the Babylonians, but it doesn't matter. It's about the same dynamic if you know the area's geography. So let me just focus on that, because that will be most of what we're going to speak about today will be Hamas. And again, as an example, take Hamas as a test case. Let me ask you this. 7-8 years ago, the whole world was bothered by ISIS. And the whole world was recruited, the coalition, all right, to take out ISIS. Was anybody thinking negotiating with ISIS? I'm asking you. Was the issue on the table? Let's negotiate? Not even once. The Western world thought that ISIS should be destroyed. Well, once you read the agenda of ISIS, and you read the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, the very same thing. So why does the world want us to negotiate with Hamas, but they refuse to negotiate with ISIS? The very same story. Once again, you hear some frustration in my voice. It's all, let me put it this way, the founder of Muslim Brotherhood, Muhammad al-Banna was his name, 1932, based a whole new theory, which was a version of Hitler's Mein Kampf, expressed in Muslim principles. Same story. No negotiations, destruction, will kill the Jews, will destroy the Jews. And that's the spirit of ISIS, for example. So why the world had the liberty to go and take out ISIS? It was not a threat, not yet. And we, facing the same issue every day, we have to be very careful. Because if one Palestinian innocent person is injured, the whole world will have something to say. Well, in the process of destroying ISIS, about 500,000 people killed. Civilians. By Russia and by the US and the coalition. Did anybody say something about these victims? I don't think so. So once again, you understand the frustration that we are feeling, because we are dealing with the same thing. The agenda, the mindset of Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood, just like ISIS. And therefore, we better understand that. So in the Gaza area, that will be our main problem, but it's a little more complicated than that, I have to say. And let me run this one through and focus for just a minute in the Gaza area. In 2005 is the year that we start a story, Israel decided that we are going to pull out from, let's call them, territories. I won't say occupied territories, because occupied territories is a misleading term, all right? Occupation is a legal term. When one sovereign nation is conquering land from another sovereign nation. Yes, we took Gaza from the Egyptians, and the West Bank we took from the Jordanians. Look back at the previous slide. How do I do that? Not working. That doesn't matter. But those territories were not supposed to be Egyptian. The Egyptians took Gaza from the Palestinians. So if you took it from somebody, then it wasn't his. He took it illegally from a third party. You can't call it occupation. Disputed territories, let's go with disputed territories. I will call them liberated territories. Is within the boundaries of the promised land. Go to Genesis 15. Once in the future, that's the land that God promised Abraham and his descendants. But that's semantics. Let's call it disputed territories, okay? The Gaza area was the one that we decided to pull out from in 2005. The plan was simple. Since the whole world back then wanted Israel to appease the Palestinians, because it will lead to peace, no doubt, if Israel is willing to give up just a little bit, it will have to lead to peace. And we said, really? Let's put it to a test. Again, I'm simplifying things a bit more complicated. We're going to pull out from Gaza. Not a single Israeli is in Gaza since September 1st, 2005. Israel officially pulled out from Gaza. That's it. How many times you hear the slogan, free Gaza, right? Banners, rallies, free Gaza. Free Gaza from whom? We are no longer there. You know that Gaza has a border on the southern part with the Egyptians. So if Gaza is in so much of a need, and they need food and medications, I'm not being cynical, because we give them them. Why won't the Egyptians supply them, the brothers, with everything that Gaza needs? Because they're more clever than we are. So the whole world says, well, Gaza is under a blockade, and it's your responsibility. Gaza is not under a blockade. The border with Egypt technically should be open. Why nobody tells the Egyptians, you should take care about Gaza? So we are being rocketed, and the world wants us to keep sending food and medication, and we do, which is the crazy thing about the whole thing. So pulling out from Gaza, we thought it's going to lead to some kind of negotiations. We did one mistake, I'll be quick to admit. We moved out from Gaza unilaterally. It wasn't through negotiation with the Palestinian Authority, which means you leave some vacuum behind, and that led to problems on the other side. Let me demonstrate that to you. A lot of things are going to come up and down, dancing, singing, etc. As we moved out from Gaza, since the Palestinians were required by the world, Condoleezza Rice was Secretary of State, if you want the world's support, you must be a democracy. Have elections, because we are not supporting tyrannies, we are not supporting dictatorships. We understand your need, but you have to be a democracy. Israeli intelligence had warned Ms. Rice and all the others, if they will have free elections, Hamas will have the upper hand. Because the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, was a group that was based on Palestinian nationalism. Hamas is a group based on religion. And for that reason, the idea was, since they're so popular, if they will win the election, as they did, it will be a new ballgame. And guess what happened? They had elections, Hamas won big time, and the PLO was shocked. They did not expect to lose. And since they refused to surrender the power and weapon, it led to a civil war among the Palestinians. So now the Palestinians are divided into two. The PLO controls the West Bank, basically, and Hamas controls Gaza. Let me take a sidetrack now. The world wants to see negotiations. Who are we supposed to talk to? The people in Gaza or those in the West Bank? They are divided. They don't talk to each other. There was a civil war. Who represents the Palestinians? Nobody. Who can deliver in their behalf? Nobody. The man that the world wants us to negotiate with, Mahmoud Abbas, president, lost the elections 14 years ago. They did not have any other election because he's going to lose for the second time. We're supposed to have ones within 2 months. And then because of COVID, because of Israel, the PLO is going to lose the West Bank as well to Hamas because Hamas is more popular. And if we will have Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank, this is a new ballgame, as you say here in America. We cannot afford ourselves such a situation. Our international airport in Ben Gurion is 3 miles away from the lines of the Palestinians. If Hamas is there, you don't understand the outcomes of such a situation. And for that reason, the question is, even if you try to exercise some logic, negotiate with the Palestinians, okay, we are willing with whom? Who is the one that represents the Palestinians? Nobody. Who can we make a deal with? Nobody. Who can deliver? Nobody. To be honest with you, on the Israeli side, we cannot deliver either under the current government, and the composition of the Israeli politics will be hard as well. The amazing thing is that the world understands it. Israel is under no pressure whatsoever for years now, since 2005. The world understands the Palestinians are not a partner, they cannot deliver, there will not be a Palestinian state until fundamental changes will take place. So suddenly we're in a very nice position. We're under no pressure from Europe or the USFA to try to appease them once again because it didn't work so far, and we tried many times. So on that level, things are changing maybe in our favor, but it doesn't stop the motivation of Hamas and the others to carry on their agendas, and let me try to focus on that in only a few minutes. Well, Israeli policy, that will be concerning the previous government we had, but the idea was that it's a nice idea to divide and conquer. We really enjoy the fact that the Palestinians are divided, because as long as they are divided, we are not requested to appease them anymore because they need to be reunited and come to the table as one body of people. Which means if you want to keep them separated, you have to negotiate with Hamas, which means you need to recognize Hamas's position to some extent. This is the last thing that you want to do, because we call Hamas usurpers. They are terrorists, although they won the elections. And if you talk to Hamas, you undermine the position of the PLO, which means we wanted them to stay divided, because as long as they are divided, the world cannot come and say, talk to them, because nobody represents them. It's a tricky policy. Am I proud of it? I'm not sure, but it worked for a while. But if you give Hamas recognition, you give them more self-confidence. Israel is willing to consider us as an entity. Why stop now? We are winning. Keep in mind this mindset. If Israel is willing to make offers and Israel is willing to negotiate, all right, we are winning. By the way, Hamas is loud and clear. We are not negotiating. Israel has one future, total eradication. Loud and clear. I'll show you some of the chapters of their charter from 1988. All right, we need to skip one or two with your permission, all right? Let's get to this one. So we do speak about an organization, which is basically Palestinian geographically. They happen to live in a place called Palestine, but the agenda is very radical Islam, based on the philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood. True, it's not just group of terror, as I prefer to call them, because they also act socially and they provide services to the people in the area. But the ultimate goal is the destruction of Israel. Every penny that was given to Hamas by the UN, the United Nations, and by the world to restore the civil infrastructure in Gaza, every penny went for terror. We used to send in sacks of concrete or cement to build houses. Not even one house was built. Everything went for tunnels, assault tunnels. The amazing thing is that you voted for these people and they keep you in such a low position, so much poverty, and you see what happens. They get the money. Where is the money? How come sometimes we are starving, we don't have roof above our heads, the money was given. Where is the money? So, I hesitate to say that, but the hatred to Israel would be much stronger than any other thinking about, let's have a better way of life. How do you raise a generation of kids
and try to hope that in the future things will be better. If that's what they basically have from the day that they are born. So on one side of the fence, Israel, a prosperous, rich country. On the other side, terrible. But again, it's not Israel's fault in a way. Money is given, food is given, fuel is given. My taxes, all right, are paying for electricity that we provide to Gaza, so they can use that in the workshop to manufacture rockets to fire at me. You tell me the reason behind it, or the wisdom behind it. Well, not everybody in Gaza is a terrorist. Gaza was, in a way, hijacked by Hamas. Many people, maybe most people, are simple people that want to live their lives peacefully. By the way, they come to work in Israel. Israel is giving 100,000 working permits every day for Palestinians to come and work in Israel. 15,000 from Gaza. By the way, they bring COVID with them. We'll take a chance. Because without those 15,000, they come to work in our country, Gaza will be bankrupt. So you tell me, why should we do that? There's no such case in world history. The two people are in some kind of a conflict, enduring fire and a round of violence. One side is sending in food and fuel and medications, which are seized by Hamas once you cross the border. So the people don't even get to see that. Give me one idea. Would any other country, one reason, any other country will behave like that? Well, I'm proud to say, I'm really proud to say, the Jewish principles are commanding us to help people as much as we can, including if these people are our enemy. You need to know that, I said with much pride. There was an Israeli task force, the first one to report in every disaster zone on the planet, if they want us. From Haiti, all the way to Turkey, all the way to Indonesia, you're always there. We don't want anybody to clap or to give us any kind of credit. Once again, human lives matter, and not everybody is a terrorist. So how do you distinguish the good guys from the bad guys when nobody wears uniforms and you can't even tell who's who? But even so, we'll take a chance and we'll supply them with whatever they need. Yes, they don't have much, but the little that they do have is coming from Israel. And we do that usually after taking fire, which is just a routine over there. I'll give you a minute to read Article 28 of the Charter of Hamas. All right? They wrote a charter in November 15, 1988. This is the proclamation of independence, so to speak. And just try to understand the sentiments. Try to understand how they see us, all right? The Jewish state is the ultimate supplier of drugs around the world. By the way, it's Syria, it's Lebanon, and Afghanistan. Most of the drugs on the planet, all right, think about heroin and opium, are coming from Afghanistan. That's how the Taliban made most of the money, from Syria and from Lebanon. So when you read that and you educate people, that many are illiterate, by the way, on that, how can you expect that something will change in the future? And the last paragraph, we cannot fail to remind every Muslim that when, just read that, we stood on Temple Mount and we shouted at Muhammad, what kind of an idiot somebody has to be, even to edit in an official document that wants to show the world, that's who we are, read, that's Hamas. Well, some people applaud for that, some people praise that kind of thinking. And they mean that. Read Article 13, the last one, I promise, I won't give you, read any other articles from the Charter, but you do understand the feeling, the sentiment, the atmosphere. And by the way, I said Hamas, call it Taliban, call it ISIS, call it Islamic Jihad, call it any name that you want. When you speak about radical Islam, not all the Muslims are radical. You speak about radical Islam, that's the agenda. By the way, how can you tell who is radical, who is not? Let's say that you're a very peaceful man, you never carried a rifle, you never pulled the trigger, but you're sending every month $100 to an organization that you know they do that in your behalf. Are you radical, yes or no? I'm asking you. You see the problem. And therefore, that will be the spirit that we have to deal with. And once again, it's not a limited geographical issue, it's global now. I think that you understand. Well, I don't want to go and be too specific because the clock is ticking and I promised Pastor Xavier that will take me about an hour, but just to understand how these people are working. Okay? It's the same as any other terror group in world history ever. Number one, you have to get rid of your own opposition. So number one, you murder your neighbors. And you murder all those who are not with you, like the PLO operatives, for example, to take over. It's interesting, when you have a dictatorship, usually it starts with democracy, but democracy has only one election. Somebody won no elections ever again. So you use democracy, basically, to destroy democracy. And that's what happens also in the case of those radical groups. That will be the way that they operate. And again, all they promise to the people is poverty, is death, is ignorance. That's the promise. Why would you vote for such a group? Because sometimes that's what makes people happy. I'm being cynical. That's your agenda. When somebody tells something like, I'm willing to sacrifice most of our people for you to suffer, how do you deal with that? The Palestinian mother that says, I lost one son, I'm willing to give all of them to liberate Jerusalem. How do you deal with that? And you hear it all the time. So you do understand the challenges that we are facing. Speaking about Hamas and the terrible condition in Gaza, because the whole world speaks about genocide and about apartheid and all those terms which sound so dramatic in a way. Nobody can explain, by the way, give an example, how is apartheid manifested in Israel? Because it's not. Very simple. Arabs in Israel are Israelis. They serve in the parliament. They have Supreme Court judges. They're Israelis like anybody else. So you say, no, you're an apartheid state vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Well, they're not part of our state. In order to be an apartheid, we have to annex their territories to make them citizens and then to oppress them. We're not even close to that stage. But how popular that can be? The Jewish state is an apartheid. So you don't have to prove anything. You don't have a clue what you're talking about. And you hear that in universities in America. I attended once one of those things and they don't let you speak. But I said, well, please give an example. You call us an apartheid state, give me one example. Shh, hush. Then somebody said, well, in the Haifa University, you don't have classes in Arabic. I said, you're right. Hebrew is our national language. Let them speak Hebrew. That was the strongest thing. So, you know, people are brainwashed. People have no idea, but it creates a certain tone. Genocide. You are murdering Palestinian kids. Well, here is the data, if you wish, all right? The lowest rate of infant mortality in the whole Arab world are Palestinians. All right? You can check my word because don't trust me. All right? Don't trust anything I'm saying. Go and check. Too much propaganda out there. When we liberated the West Bank in 1967, the lifespan of an Arab male was 48 years. Today is 81. Population grows all the time. That doesn't go in line with genocide, right? Where the population grows all the time. So all those nonsense that they throw at you, and this coalition of the media and the academia is devastating. And you can't contradict it because you don't have a voice over there. I can go and speak in places. Friends of Israel know that. In state universities, here in California, no way. Nobody wants to hear the facts because they made up their minds already. Who cares about the truth anymore? It's frustrating. So I hope it's not that much in the universities, but in Friends of Israel. And this church is a friend of Israel. I know Pastor Xavier for many years. I know some of your faces around here. So don't trust what I'm saying. Some of you have been to Israel. You don't see the Arabs oppressed. You don't see concentration camps of Arabs. They are part of the state of Israel with all the rights like anybody else. They can even join the army if they want to. It's not mandatory. Can Muslims practice Sharia law in the great state of California? I'm asking you. No, they cannot. They cannot. There are no Sharia law courthouses in California that the state will recognize. They can in Israel. Israel is recognizing Islam and Sharia law as a legitimate religion to practice, including courthouses, including muezzin, screams from the rooftop and wakes you up at 5 a.m. It's okay, just about, we are so accustomed to. I'm sorry for being kind of provocative about that. And who is the oppressed and who are the brutal ones? Israel. Because who cares about the facts? Nobody checks the facts anymore. Please, go and check. Don't trust what I'm saying. I have an agenda. I cannot be trusted. I'm an Israeli. All right? Check it. It's there. And therefore, we are dealing with something that, number one, we have to convince the world what is the nature of it. And governments begin to understand. Not the people, but governments begin to understand. To go a little deeper and to explain about the things that happen in the Gaza area, I do want to skip some of it with your permission. The clock is ticking. Once we understood that Hamas is digging tunnels under the fence into Israel, that was a game changer, right? We had to respond somehow. And the somehow was basically by developing a whole system. Today, they cannot, because we have a very solid steel wall that goes all along it, and digging under it will be almost impossible. So they understand that this path is blocked, so they developed rockets and weapons. Everything comes from Iran, by the way, including the money and the technology. So now we are dealing with rockets, and they're getting more sophisticated. After Libya collapsed, remember? Gaddafi, one of those names from the past, for six months, the arsenals of the Libyan army were wide open to anybody, to come and take whatever they wanted. And guess where some of the equipment ended up in? Through Egypt in Gaza. So that was the platform that they were building on. So our retaliation was basically developing a weapon system that I think that some of you heard about, which is called the Arrow and the Iron Dome. It's one weapon system which is kind of a very sophisticated, defensive. It made a big noise about 3 weeks ago because the Congress here did not, basically they had to separate that from the budget or from the amount of money that the U.S. is giving to Israel every year, $1.8 billion. We can only buy weapons which are manufactured in America. So in a way, it's also supporting your economy, which is fine, we're not complaining, right? But the question was, why do we need to supply Israel weapons? Because they're killing the Palestinians. So they took this aside and they voted just for that with a huge majority in the House, okay? Defensive weapon system. Local technology, American money, most of it. By the way, Korea, South Korea will get also, because they're in a similar situation, it's a good system. I'm taking a sidetrack for a minute. Israel was known for years and years and years. When there's a problem, we know how to deal with it. If we need to move in, we move in. We get things done, we come out. Today, the mindset is a little different. The mindset is more defensive. Because we cannot just go in and out to Iran, for example. There's an air force, they can do some maybe damage, I don't know. But the whole mindset in Israel is changing now from being a little more aggressive or offensive to be more defensive. That's bad. Usually defense doesn't win wars, usually. All right, but today it's changing. And the Iron Dome, as great as it is, as technology, presents a problem. Let me tell you why. If we did not have the Iron Dome, if it wasn't a weapon system that we developed and have, and rockets that fired from Gaza will kill 20 Israelis, will wipe Gaza out. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever. We only retaliate in such a mild manner because the Iron Dome is so good. They fire rockets, we intercept most of them, so there's no reason to rush, no reason to act kind of fast and brutally because no damage was done. Now for the people in Gaza, the fact that they fired the rockets is a victory for themselves. Did I say, we rocketed Tel Aviv today? Well, you launched the rockets, they didn't go in even halfway, we intercepted them, it doesn't matter. We fired at Tel Aviv. So you do understand that the Iron Dome is protecting Gaza more than it protects Israel. Make sense? In other words, if we did not have the Iron Dome, they should thank us for developing the Iron Dome. But the whole world is really kind of amazed because it's amazing technology. It's not a dumb rocket, all right? It will go after the missile if need like that until you hit it. And again, 89%, they scored, which is not bad. It has a radar that within 1/10 of a second, you can tell if the rocket fired from Gaza where it's going to land, And if it's going to land in a non-vacant area, in a vacant area, don't even bother. Let it fall. If it's going to land in a place which is inhabited, you intercept it. Which means that the Israeli mindset is changing. It's changing because we cannot retaliate effectively against Iran, for example. We need to go through all of Syria if we want to do something using boots on the ground. But it's not good, if I may say so. Because the whole idea was, when there's a problem, you have to take action. And the action right now is more defensive. Let me ask you a question of philosophy, not a question of strategy. Let's say that Iran will have a nuclear weapon, which is possible. Somebody in Iran will decide, one of the Ayatollahs over there, that the time is right. They'll press the button. A rocket is flying at Israel's direction, a ballistic missile outside the atmosphere. We intercept it. No damage was done. We can carry on having our coffees in our living rooms. It's all good. Do we have the right to retaliate with our nuclear weapons, which we never admitted that we have, by the way, knowing that Iran is not protected and hundreds of thousands will be killed? What say you? Don't answer, because we cannot really answer. But you understand the dilemma. It's a question of philosophy, of moral values. But it may happen. So today the question suddenly is not who has the weapon, but who is protected from the weapon. Which means you're thinking defense all the time. And that's not good. So we're not moving into Gaza, because we can deal with Gaza. Yes, people will be killed. But 3 million Israelis are running to the bomb shelters whenever somebody in Gaza decides that he had an argument with his wife last night and he's upset. He'll fire a rocket. Sometimes that's a motivation. We speak about gangs, militias. How do you prove yourself to be a hero? You fire a rocket. Which means that everybody in the country goes to the bomb shelter. Think about the economy. Think about the long-term consequences, even on kids. You grow up like this. You go to school, and suddenly the siren goes on, and you have 7 seconds, 7 seconds to run to the shelter, or you may be dead. And you see the kids, they know. So in some places in Israel, along the borders with Gaza, you have, by every bus stop, and there are many, you have a little cube made of concrete, that's your bomb shelter. Who can live like that? And therefore, when we need to deal with Gaza, instead of doing that in a way, and this opinion of mine is not popular in the country, okay? And we can take Gaza out. Not everybody. And yes, people will be killed. It's a war. But think about the Israeli side. We are willingly living in a situation that every now and then, half of the country's population is living in bomb shelters. In COVID days and social distancing, sometimes, and they said it, Hamas said it, we are going to fire rockets just to make sure that you run to the bomb shelters, you'll be infected, you'll die out of COVID. I kid you not, an official policy for at least a month. By the way, they died of COVID, although nobody knows the numbers even. And it goes on and on and on. I don't want to take too much of your time, just to point at some of those principles. And you do see this over there. Read the words of Colonel Richard Camp, or the commander of the British troops in Afghanistan. Amen to that. I was invited by the UN to speak, and people just looked at him. Yeah, these are the facts. And the facts are very simple to confirm and to verify, but who cares about the truth anymore? Well, I guess some people do. Some people do. And the whole purpose behind that presentation here this evening is to tell you that it doesn't happen in a remote part of the globe. Everybody is going to be part of that agenda. We need to understand what is it that we are facing, and to be ready to understand that maybe it will take measures that democracies usually don't know how to take. The way to win terror is to become a terrorist. Democracies don't know how to be terrorists, which is a good thing. And therefore, it looks like we have a disadvantage. We need to compromise some principles. So we will. But we don't want to be terrorists in order to fight terrorism. That's the way to do that. So we're investing a fortune to minimize collateral damage. Investing a fortune to be so precise and accurate. You can fire rockets from 10 kilometers today into a window about this size. Only taking out who you need to take out. On the other side, you fire a rocket into Israel. You want to kill as many civilians as possible. That's the whole idea behind this rocket. Not very accurate. He wanted to fall in the center of a big city to take as many lives as possible. That's terror. And we, the West, is inventing weapons to try to minimize to the maximum collateral damage. The other side doesn't even try. So here is an interesting formula, right, which is really irritating. Dead Israelis are very good to Hamas. Very bad to Israel. Dead Palestinians, very good to Hamas. Very bad to Israel. So the way that we see that sometimes, it's a lose-lose. And Hamas basically is surviving thanks to Iran. So once again, we close the circle to go back to the motivation, to the sponsor, to who is behind part of that hatred which is growing all the time. But step number one is to deal within the Muslim world and then united, consolidated, to take the war into the West. That was the plan of ISIS, and for that reason was important to finish them up before they accomplished this consolidation plan, the caliphate, all the Muslims together. For that reason, the world was so bothered by the threat of ISIS. Hamas is still there. Taliban is still there. Same philosophy, same idea. Distance will not make any difference here. But the world is getting smaller and smaller. And I think that we'll bring it to conclusion here because it is indeed an hour. Exactly an hour. Folks, as I said, it's a message which is not pleasant sometimes to share or sometimes to understand. As I started, that was my opening comment, which is important for me to close with as well. You can come to the conclusion that people in Israel live an impossible way of life. You're absolutely wrong. Okay? Because life goes on. People out in the streets. The country grows. More people come to live with us. Prosperity, tranquility. We are a villa in the jungle. The only Arabs in the region which are safe are the Israeli Arabs, not all the others. We just see, and we watch very carefully, the tension building up around us. And we are strong enough, if necessary, not just to protect ourselves, but to take out any potential enemy. We have no doubts and no hesitations whatsoever. Sometimes people say Israel has the right to protect itself, to justify Israel's retaliation. Well, thank you very much. A mouse has the right to protect himself as well. That's not good enough. How about Israel has the right to take out any potential enemy? Anybody will make such a statement among world leaders? No. Just to protect yourself. Well, again, this is the Western mindset. Because the others, they don't really mean that. They're good people. So protect yourself, don't attack them, and then you can talk about it. Doesn't work like that. Whenever some common sense is coming closer to the Middle East, it stops someplace in Cyprus, never makes it to the Middle East. Things are working in a different way, different mindset, different way of thinking. The Western mindset cannot comprehend it. So we have a big misunderstanding. Where do we go from here and how exactly? We believe that Israel can be a great bridge, a mediator, because we live there. We are a Western country, at least I believe so. We are closer to understand the mentality than any other country in the West. Use us. Give you some good advices what exactly happens in the region. It's getting there. Because governments begin to understand the problem is global and we have to respond now before it's going out of control. Look at the Muslim immigration into Europe. Many European countries are taking a huge chance of survival. They're losing the nature almost completely. You can't speak against it because it's not PC. But the governments are learning. So this is another positive thing, the way we see it at least, that leaders around the world begin to understand that what Israel was saying for years and years and years, it is indeed a global issue. Let's get together. Let's try to understand the mentality. Let's use the Israeli experience to try to work through there to understand how things need to be done. It may get to that, may not. God is good. We do know how the book ends, and we do know why we are there. We are there because God keeps his promises. And to my generation, the first generation of Jewish men and women that can really say that we are free in our own country after 2,000 years of exile, after our mothers and fathers died in the Holocaust, God chose to keep his promise in our generation. It's awesome. I do not take it for granted. Thank you. Do we have questions, Pastor? Anybody? Any questions, anything whatsoever? I know it's a lot. It's a lot to process, and I just kind of fell on you with all this depressing information. Anything at all? Yes, sir. Yeah, question was about the presence of Russia in Syria and how it's affecting, I'm kind of paraphrasing, and how it's affecting what Israel does in Syria. Yes, Russia is in Syria. Russia is invited into Syria. I mean, the Russians can say, listen, all the other powers in Syria are there illegally. Well, you're invited, and they're right. In 2014, the Assad regime invited Russia officially to protect the regime. And Russia was more than happy to assist. Because Russia, in order to restore the position to be a power once again as they used to be, they need to have hot water harbors. The harbors in Russia, except for the Black Sea, are freezing 8 months of the year. They cannot use their navy. That's how you become a global power, by using the navy in most cases. So they need bases in the Mediterranean. And they used to have them. And Syria said, fine, you'll get two bases for your navy, and you have the regime. So Russia is there, invited by the regime officially, and they're playing kind of a game which is sometimes strange, because they do protect the regime in a way. But here's the problem. Russia supplies the Syrians with a lot of weapons as well. Now Israel is taking out targets of Iran in Syria, and the Syrian air defense tries to shut down Israeli airplanes. In our retaliation, we take out the whole battery of rockets over there that was given by Russia. And the Russians are saying, well, we understand what you need to do, but basically you destroy our equipment. So what do you want us to do? Sell them more. That's how you make money, right? We'll take them out, you sell them more. So Russia sometimes says, well, do not retaliate, because if you do, basically you are showing the Syrians that your weapons are superior to our rockets. And they will not trust us anymore. You don't understand how complicated things can get. And therefore, we have to be very careful how we are going to navigate our way vis-a-vis Russia, because, you know, Putin is quite an aggressive ruler, and he doesn't hide his intentions either. So Russia is a new player in the region, which may be a problem in the future. Right now, we're working together. There is an understanding. How things will evolve, we wait and see. Yes, sir. Well, question about China. China has an issue with the Muslim nation. Because China has a group of people called the Uyghurs, a couple of tens of millions who are Muslims. And the Russians are oppressing them in such a severe way, re-educating them. So technically, China and Islam have an issue. That will be on this party, on this side. But China will seize every opportunity in the region, including in Israel. All right, I hate to say that, but and again, there was an issue between us and the US of A. Because the Chinese bought a harbor in Israel. All right? And again, they cannot do that without our consent. Negotiations, they just dedicated about a week ago a new harbor in the Haifa area, which is Chinese operated. Of course, there was a deal between the governments. The problem is that the harbor of Haifa is the home bay of the American Sixth Fleet that navigates the Mediterranean, which means American ships are going to come to the docks and take shelter, being supplied, etc., right under the eyes of who knows what the Chinese are working on these cranes. They can see every ship. You don't understand globalism? Well, there you got globalization, okay? Here's another aspect of it. So China officially not really involved. China sells a lot of equipment to Iran, by the way. All right? So China is involved, but not directly. There was one regiment of Chinese volunteers that was deployed in Syria under Iran. But it was not a China as a state. It was a group of volunteers. So China and Islam are not in good relations right now because of the Uyghurs, which is a minority. But in China, a minority can be 100 million. About 20-30 million of Muslims, basically. Chinese Muslims, which are really suppressed by the regime. It's a complicated world that we live in. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
How about the natural
Question about the treasures of oil and gas found in the Mediterranean. Well, gas. Lots of gas was found. And there was something in the world, I would say, the way that the world operates financially, economically, you do have your territorial water and you have your commercial water or your economic water, which gives you more space. And in that water, we found a huge reservoir of gas. And Israel is going to be a supplier of energy to Europe. I mean, this is amazing, that we are going to be providing basically gas for the Europeans to heat their homes in the winter, because everything they get today comes from Russia. And if Putin doesn't want to, the people in Germany will freeze to death. So as we speak now, they're finishing a pipeline that goes under the Mediterranean, the longest in the world, will go to Italy, and Israel is going to sell gas, right, to Europe, and this will be a great strategic asset. The problem is that Turkey stepped in to say, well, it's Mediterranean. Why should only Israel enjoy that? Well, because we looked for it, we paid for it, we found it, so we don't want to share, isn't it? So these places that we pump this gas out are prime targets for Hezbollah and all the others, so we have to train specifically or buy equipment of Iron Dome batteries, which are basically mounted on ships, all right, just to protect those places from any potential threat. So this is another kind of a mini Iron Dome system, which is another amazing accomplishment. Yes, so Turkey wants to enjoy part of it as well. Well, it's a big Mediterranean. You go, you dig, you find, you can keep it, but don't want any of it. And the last one, yes, sir.
Yes, you mentioned all these different countries. You omitted Pakistan, which Pakistan is
there. Yeah, question was about Pakistan again. You can't really name every single country in the region, but Pakistan definitely is a nuclear country with a not very stable regime as well. One of the fears of the West is that Pakistan will fall to the hands of some crazy groups over there. Same with Kazakhstan. Right? Kazakhstan is a Muslim country, a former Soviet Union, have nuclear weapons. So it's not that rare to have nuclear weapons anymore. Right? Go to the internet, Google. You can build one at home. Huh? That's what they say. So it's not that rare anymore. And Pakistan, basically, Pakistan plays a very interesting game. Allies of the U.S. officially, housing a lot of anti-American groups. It's almost like Qatar, right? Qatar is the biggest supporter of terrorism in the world, period. Just go and check, okay? Qatar and Al Jazeera. Now, the U.S. has a huge naval base in Qatar because it's right on the Iranian borders over there, so you understand the strategic significance. And we made peace with the Arab Emirates. One reason was that we are right on the borders of Iran, which means we can gather a lot of information being so close to Iranian borders. Same with Azerbaijan, we're good friends, Muslim country. Reason is because Azerbaijan has a border with Iran, which means that Israeli, the right personnel, Mossad operatives, whatever, we can be right on the borders of Iran, which they don't, and gather information and collect data, etc. So Pakistan is a headache, but to the whole world, especially to India, more than to any other country in the region. Folks, thank you so much. I'm going to bed. I don't know about your plans, but thank you.